Now we're going to turn our attention now to the Word of God, and we're reading together in Matthew's Gospel chapter 27 from verse 55 right through to the end of that chapter and into the beginning of chapter 28. And that's around page 1000 of the church Bibles, which, as many of you know, are underneath the chairs in front of you. We've been following Matthew's Gospel, this tail end of Matthew's Gospel, really since Christmas time, working our way through the last few chapters and taking time paragraph by paragraph to think about what Jesus said and did and what happened to him. And we had got up to the stage around Easter time of his crucifixion, his arrest and trial by the Jews and the Romans, and then his being put to death on the cross. And over the last couple of times I was with you, that's the passage that we've been looking at right up to the moment when Jesus breathed his last or gave up his spirit and died, causing the earth to shake and the centurion and those who are with him to say, surely he was the Son of God. And that happened about 3 o'clock on the Friday afternoon, the day before the Sabbath, what was called Preparation Day, as people prepared for every week the Sabbath festival, on this occasion also for the Passover festival, which was about to be celebrated. And the passage we read tonight describes what happens next, really during those last 3 hours in the Friday and then into the following day. So beginning in verse 55, it tells us that many women were there, watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. And as evening came, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. And going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he'd cut out of the rock. And he rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. The next day, the one after Preparation Day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. Sir, they said, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days I will rise again. So, give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first. Take a guard, Pilate answered. Go, make the tomb as secure as you know how. And so they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. And at that point you could go da da da, and that's the cliffhanger for next week. If you were doing that kind of thing, if you were writing fiction, writers of fiction have a great advantage, which is that they can do whatever they want. They can invent the characters that they want to appear in their story, and they can dress them how they please and make them ugly or beautiful or eloquent or athletic or whatever they want. They can arrange the circumstances. They can tell whatever story it is that suits them. They can put people to death if they want. They can crown kings or queens or have presidents elected. They can fulfill or destroy the dreams of the people they are writing about. They can even, if they want, write science fiction or fantasy novels in which they can break the laws of nature so they can make the animals talk or the dragons fly. In fact, if you want, as a writer of fiction, you can even make the gods do whatever pleases you. But for a writer of history, it's obviously more difficult. Now, we know that history is written in different ways by different people. So the way things are recorded can reflect the bias or the interests of the particular writer or their employer. But nevertheless, there are limitations because some of the facts and figures are established. So, for example, it would be difficult to write a history of the 19th century and have Napoleon win the Battle of Waterloo. And just as difficult to write a history of the 20th century and have West Germany win the World Cup in 1966. People might notice. You can't break the normal laws of nature. If you make a mistake, then people will say it couldn't have happened like that because such and such were the rules or such and such is the science. So your version of events as a historian is at the mercy of other people who were there at the time or people who have access to other sources of evidence or people who just understand how these things work. Now, it's quite clear that what Matthew is trying to write here is a record of historical events. He's unashamed about having an ulterior motive. He's not just a newspaper reporter. He's a disciple of Jesus persuading other people to make the decision to follow him. But he's not just a teller of tales, a minstrel looking for ways to fill in a long winter's night. He's someone who sets his story among real events in a real place, affecting real people in Jerusalem in the first century. And the story he tells explains the birth of a church, which was a real social phenomenon that many of the people he was writing to were part of at the time. So he has to get it right. But he has a problem, because he knows that dead people don't come back to life. That sounds like fiction. That sounds like fantasy. So how can he go about writing a historical account of someone who did do exactly that? And actually the problem, if you read carefully, the problem is implicit in the story. In verses 63 and 4, we are told that Jesus' enemies, the Jewish authorities, recalled Jesus' claim that he would come back to life. After 3 days, I will rise again, they remembered him saying. But although they'd heard that, it never crossed their minds that it could actually be true. They took account of the claim and they took measures to prevent anything being done about it. But the measures Jesus' enemies took were to stop disciples getting into the tomb, not to stop a risen Jesus getting out. So they just knew that couldn't happen. It didn't even cross their minds. So how does Matthew set out to deal with that conviction? Well, if you look carefully at the story that he tells, you will notice, first of all, that he includes three times in verses 56 and 61 in chapter 28, verse 1, he includes the two Marys, Mary Magdalene and the mother of James and Joseph, and another woman who is said to be the mother of Zebedee's sons. He names them and positions them in his story, in spite of the fact that they don't do anything. They appear later on into chapter 28, but Matthew introduces them earlier at this point of the story because although they don't do anything, they sit there and watch. And so Matthew is saying people saw what happened. And as eyewitnesses, these women guarantee two things. First of all, that the man who was crucified on the cross is the same man who was put into the tomb, because they watched as he was taken down and carried and placed in the tomb, and the stone was rolled away. So no one's making assumptions that because there was a death in one place and a burial in another, it must have been the same person. They actually saw it happening. And then secondly, they saw that it was the same tomb, the one they went back to the following morning or two mornings later, which was found to be empty. So again, there's no question of mistaken identity, that years later somebody claimed one tomb had been empty and folks put two and two together and got five. They saw Jesus from the cross into the tomb, and in the morning the same tomb empty. Or at least they say they did. Of course, the fact that someone makes a claim doesn't make it true, and we would have to assess that. It's possible that the women were liars or that Matthew was a liar. But by giving these women names and sons, effectively names and addresses, Matthew is saying, if you don't believe me, go and ask them for yourself. Not something we can do, of course, but something his readers at the time could have done and probably would have done. And instead of passing this book down to us to be read and revered, they would have chucked it in the bin if Mary Magdalene had said, yes, I was there, and that wasn't what happened at all. So either the women are blatant liars, caught up in some kind of plot of Matthew's to deceive people, or else they are telling the truth. So first of all, he puts the woman watching outside the tomb, and then he explains the tomb itself and how Jesus' body ended up there. You see, normally when people were crucified by the Romans, their bodies were left hanging on the cross for days and days as a warning to others. That was part of the horror of the judgment. Or else they were taken down and simply tossed into waste ground, where no doubt very soon wild animals would come and defile them. And even in sensitive Jewish society, where things were done different, the best that would happen would be that a crucified body would be taken and tossed into a common grave without any distinctions or without any markers. So normally, if Matthew had simply said, I want to tell you about this story of Jesus Christ who was crucified, and then 3 days later or on the third day the tomb was empty, anyone who knew how these things worked would have said, that can't be true, because he wouldn't have been in a tomb in the first place. And Matthew's aware of that possibility. He's not making a story up. He's found out what happens. And so he tells the story of Joseph of Arimathea to explain the exceptional but entirely credible circumstances by which this crucified man did end up in a tomb, which could be identified as the one that was empty on Easter Sunday morning. And he even explains in verse 60 that it was Joseph's own new tomb in which Jesus was placed. You see, it would have been a family vault that in normal circumstances over a period of time would have been filled up with a number of bodies of people related to whichever family it was. And that was perhaps grounds for confusion. The number of bodies could have been uncertain and someone could have counted wrong, but it was a new tomb that was absolutely empty before Jesus was placed in it, as well as absolutely empty afterwards. And so another possibility of confusion is eliminated. Again, none of this proves anything. Matthew could be making it all up and just writing down what suits him, although, again, Joseph is the kind of person you could have gone and asked. He was a well-known, high-profile public figure. But at least he is putting together a story that works. And actually, just thinking about Joseph for a moment, I think he presents us with a significant challenge. Matthew tells us in verse 57 that Joseph had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Now, that's all we know. We don't know how it happened. Was Joseph converted during Easter week, perhaps by Jesus preaching in the temple, or perhaps even during the witness of Jesus at his trial? Or had he become a follower of Jesus earlier on? We know that Jesus came to Jerusalem on a number of previous occasions to different religious festivals. Had Joseph met with him then? Or had Joseph simply heard the stories about Jesus without meeting him in the flesh the way that you and I do, and yet we come to faith? We don't know any of that, but we do know that this is the first we've ever heard of Joseph as a disciple of Jesus. He's a new figure so far as Matthew is concerned. So he can't have been part of the inner circle. You see, in other bits of the gospel, when it says Jesus went into a room with his disciples, Joseph wasn't there. So he wasn't the best prepared, the best taught, the most influenced or intimately cared for of Jesus' disciples. He certainly wasn't one that the others looked to for leadership, and he certainly wasn't one to whom specific responsibility had been given. It's your job to do this, Joseph. None of that. And yet what we see here, Matthew shows us quite clearly all the other disciples who had promised Jesus that they would stand by him. We saw all the other disciples drifting away and disappearing off into hiding. And as they step back from the scene, Joseph steps forward. When the others go into hiding, Joseph comes out into the open, right into the open. He goes into Pilate's palace, for goodness sake, to speak with the most important and powerful man in that part of the world about Jesus. And then he goes to a place of public execution that is deliberately located so that everybody can see it. And he takes the body down. And then he places it in his own brand new tomb, again, presumably in a relatively high profile place, in an act so shocking and countercultural that it would almost certainly have been the talk of the steamy in Jerusalem that night. So he knows he's taking risks, he knows probably he's making enemies, and yet he doesn't seem to care. Now, some of this, I think, is just about opportunity. There weren't probably many other disciples who would have had the social class or status that would have gained them access to Pilate. And there probably weren't many others who had a brand new empty tomb of their own that they could have used. So part of this is just about God bringing into the story at the right time and place the people with the resources and the gifts and the talents that he needs to do what he wants at that time. The whole body of Christ combines and each person plays their part. But I think you'll agree with me that it's also a story about courage. Because it would have been dead easy, probably almost inevitable, for Joseph, the fringe disciple, to have said to himself, look, where's Peter? He should be doing something about this. He was around here earlier somewhere. I saw him before. Where's he gone to? And if he has disappeared, then why shouldn't I? Or looked around and said, there, over there, there is the mother of Zebedee's sons, the mother of James and John, the sons of thunder. If they've done a runner, then why shouldn't I? We would be right to understand that Christianity is about corporate responsibility. A disciplined church with appointed leaders planning its mission strategy, and then all taking concerted action together. And in that understanding, there were people around whose jobs it was to do this. But there are times when leaders fail or disappear or become unavailable for other reasons. Jesus is dead. Peter has fled. And so there's no one left except Joseph. And there he is faced with this choice, either of stepping up to the mark and doing what no one else will, or hiding behind and along with the others. And I just wonder whether there might be some of us who face that kind of choice today, or might at some point in the future. when we will find ourselves given the chance to go with the flow of other Christians who are compromising or frightened or just doing what comes easily. And at such a time, you might need to ask yourself, perhaps I am the one that God has called to go alone where no one else might follow, or to say the things that no one else wants to hear, or to do what is dangerous or hard even for my fellow Christians to understand, let alone the rest of my relatives and friends. And yet I am going to do that in obedience to God. Not looking around for Peter or James or John to help or take the lead or do beside me, but looking to God and saying, I'm going to do for him. So this is Joseph's moment. It's his first and last mention in the story. So if he hadn't done this day, then for all Matthew cares, he might have well used the tomb himself that day and lain down and died in it. It wouldn't have made any difference. But instead he came and he asked and he took and he wrapped and he placed and he rolled the stone and only then went away. And because he did that, the scene was set for the proclamation of the glory of the resurrection of the Lord. I wonder if there's anyone who needs to be Joseph today. But then we come to the guard at the empty tomb. Now, we already know it really was Jesus who was crucified, because passers-by recognized him on the cross. Other traditions suggest a different person was crucified instead of Jesus, and that's how he was still alive on the third day. But folks came along and pointed at him and talked to him and recognized him and didn't say, you've got the wrong man. And we know he was really dead. It's been suggested by some folks that maybe he fainted and recovered and rolled the stone away himself and got out without anybody noticing. But the Roman execution squad, who'd seen this kind of thing before, talked about how he died. So Jesus was dead and in the tomb. But hearing that his body was in this tomb, the Jewish authorities realized that his disciples now have the opportunity to talk about resurrection if they could only get their hands on the body and steal it away. And so they decide to make sure that claim becomes impossible by placing the guard. And it's part of Matthew's deliciously rich irony in this story that it's Jesus' enemies who rule out for us the possibility of body snatching, so that whatever other explanation we might come up with, we're not left with that one. Now, again, you might say that's only if you believe Matthew's version of events. He could have invented the guards to make his story more convincing. He is, after all, the only one of four gospel writers who mentions them, so perhaps he has embellished the story to make it easier to believe. People in the United States of America this week have been reliving the famous O.J. Simpson murder trial, because a new film has just been released about it. 20 years ago, O.J. Simpson, a famous American football player, was accused of murdering his ex-wife. But after a long, dramatic, high-profile trial, he was eventually found not guilty. And one of the things that emerged at his trial was that policemen, who apparently in all other circumstances were men of real integrity and dedication to their job, policemen fabricated evidence to secure the conviction. You see, they on the inside were absolutely sure this man had committed the murder, and they wanted to make sure that the jury got it and convicted the right man. And what they did was they took a lab sample of the victim's blood that had been kept. They took it out of the laboratory, used it to stain some of O.J. Simpson's clothes, and then planted the clothes in his bedroom so that it looked as though there was direct evidence connecting him with the scene of the crime. Is it possible that in just the same way Matthew plants these guards outside the tomb to make his story more convincing? Well, the lesson from the O.J. Simpson trial, of course, is that that kind of planting can backfire. The defense counsel were able to use scientific evidence to prove what had actually happened, and the net effect in the minds of the jury was not only to cancel that bit of evidence, but to make them question whether all the other evidence the police also presented might have been fabricated too. If you read to the end of Matthew's account, you'll see that he claims in chapter 28, verse 13, that the guards were bribed by the priests to say that the disciples came at night to steal the body while they slept. But then he says in verse 15, and this is critical, then he says in verse 15, this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. And at that point, he knows his readers, the Jews of that very day, were nodding their heads in agreement. They'd heard the story. Because that's the thing about writing history. You cannot make up things that people have heard about already. Those are the things you have to tie your story in with. So the guards must have been there that night. And this story about disciples stealing the body must have been told. Otherwise Matthew wouldn't have got away with that. So the choice you're left with is this, that either frightened disciples crept up on those guards at night, somehow slipped past them, managed in complete silence to roll a big stone away, shifted the body out, and carried it away with them, all without disturbing those men whose job it was specifically to look out for them. Or the body rose from the dead. And I have to say that as a relatively intelligent, rational thinker, I simply don't have enough blind faith to believe in the face of the evidence that Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead. And that was clearly the unforgettable claim that he had made. Sir, the authorities said to Pilate, we remember that while he was alive, that deceiver said, after 3 days, I will rise again. They'd heard that in his trial at chapter 26, verse 61, the allegation that he claimed he could rebuild the temple within 3 days if it had been destroyed. That story was common knowledge in Jerusalem, because in chapter 27, verse 40, the passers-by used it to mock Jesus hanging on the cross. And so perhaps the priests, having heard that claim, had made the same connection that John made in his gospel in chapter 2, verse 21, when he realized the temple Jesus was speaking about was his body. Destroy it in 3 days, I will rebuild it. Or maybe they had understood the answer Jesus gave to some Pharisees back in chapter 12, verse 40, when they went to Jesus and said, give me some miraculous signs to prove that you really are who you claim to be. And Jesus said, no signs will be given to this wicked generation except for one, the sign of the prophet Jonah. For as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. There was a puzzler to think about if ever there was one. How can a story told hundreds of years ago be a proof, a miraculous proof of Jesus? But of course, the point is that after 3 days in the heart of the earth, Jesus came back from the dead, just as after 3 days buried in the whale, Jonah appeared. And then went on to preach the need for repentance and salvation, not to complacent Jews who already knew that stuff, but to a bunch of Gentiles who didn't believe any of it. And remarkably, a whole city full of them, convinced by the appearance of this man, turned to the Lord and were saved. Or maybe the Jewish authorities had simply had it betrayed to them by Judas Iscariot, the traitor, the private predictions that Jesus had made to his disciples. Chapter 16 and verse 21, chapter 17 and verse 23, chapter 20 and verse 19, Jesus said, "On the third day, he, the Son of Man, will be raised to life." Now, to the disciples, at the time, those predictions didn't make any sense. And afterwards, they seemed too good to be true. So, on the day of his death and the 2 days afterwards, they had no hope. They were as far as they could be from looking for a risen Jesus, let alone creeping about at night to try and steal his body. But to his enemies, we see here clearly, those predictions were too dangerous to ignore. Because they knew that even if all they had was a stolen body, then Jesus' disciples might wreak havoc, so far as they were concerned. So what if the body they had was not dead, but alive? What terrible things might happen then? Disciples made of all nations. Believers baptized in Jesus' name. People submitting to his heavenly authority and obeying his commands and knowing that they were with him always to the very end of the age. So you see, these Jewish enemies of Jesus were wiser than they knew, because they knew that if they didn't act to stop this happening, they wouldn't be able to stop the gospel spreading. So thank goodness. Thank goodness for us. They did what they did. Because it's thanks to them that we are where we are today. I pray that God will follow with his blessing the reading and the preaching of his word.